Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Welcome to the Billboard Sharpie Podcast. Gary Trust, Billboard's Senior Director of Charts.
And this is Andrew Unterberger, Senior Editor over on the digital side.
You're not Trevor Anderson.
I'm not, no. Few among us are, truly.
Trevor is off this week on vacation somewhere, but we'll be in fine shape with you. Andrew, you've been on before. People might know you from Billboard's Coming Around Again podcast, too, which...
A little flashback there, sure, yeah.
Is it coming around again?
It's inactive for the time being, still on hiatus. We're like One Direction, right? Maybe it'll come back someday, but, don't put it on your calendar necessarily for any time soon.
All right. So we're going to talk, as usual, Hot 100 this week, especially number one, because the artist at number one is having one of the most historic years ever on the Hot 100. So we're going to try to decide, is he having the best year anyone has ever had in the entire 60-year history of the Hot 100, going back to the beginning in 1958? Well, I should go back a little bit before then, I think, because there was someone right before the Hot 100 started that I think deserves a mention of that. But yeah, we're going to try to figure out. Drake is the artist this year, setting all these records, and we'll get into that in just a moment when we run down the top 10 on this week's Hot 100. So yeah, that's what we're trying to find out this week. Who's had the best year ever on the Hot 100? So, plus to wrap things up, flashback as always. We're going to go back to a song that was a really big hit 10 years ago this week. Huge stars all over it. I feel like people might have totally forgotten about it, though.
Yeah, I mean, I'm curious when you say the song, if people will even be able to. Will they be able to hear it in their head? Will they be able to identify the collective artist name behind it? Will they be able to name some of the artists who are on the song? I don't know. I don't know if I was able to do any of that when you told me we'd be talking about the song on the segment. It's funny how some of these songs, that they make an immediate impact and then feels like 2 years later that they're totally erased from history almost.
Also, it helped raise money and awareness for an important cause too. So if nothing else, it did what it was supposed to do. So that's on the way. Let's get into it as always. This week's top 10 on the Billboard Hot 100.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Tell me why you never lie.
Number 10.
Yesterday you spend the night underneath the sunrise. Show me where your love lies.
Let you get a taste. Do you let it taste? Yeah, that's cool, but he ain't like me.
Number 9.
A lot of
9.
Girls like me, niggas wanna fight me. Nigga, get your ass checked like a fucking Nike. Me, not icy. That's
back in high school, I used to bust it to the dance.
Yeah.
Now I hit the FBO with duffels in my hands.
Number 8.
I did half a Xan, 13 hours till I land. Had me out like a light, ay, like a light, ay, like a light.
I don't really want no friends.
Number 7.
I don't really want no friends.
He trying to 69 like Tekashi. Call him Papi. Worth the ASAP. Keep me rocky. I'm from New York, so I'm cocky.
Such a fucking hoe. I love it.
Number 6.
You're such a fucking hoe. I love it.
You're such a fucking hoe. When the first time they ask you, you want.
I still see your shadows in my room.
Number 5.
Can't take back the love that I gave you. It's to the point why I love and I hate.
la cruz tengo el azúcar.
You got me, me do what I want when I come through. I need a girl like you, yeah. Yeah, 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 yeah. I need a cookie.
Do you love me?
And number one.
Say you never ever leave from beside me. Cause I want you and I need you. And I'm down for you always, KB. Do you love me? Are you riding?
All right, so Drake, number one again. It's been pretty much all 74% of the year.
Drake, yeah, it feels like a long time since we were talking about anybody else in number one. I mean, I know there are a couple minor detours in there, but you know, you'll look back on this in a couple of years, and it'll just feel like Drake was number one for the entire year, basically.
Yeah. So actually, it was really, really close this week. Girls Like You, we heard at number two. Maroon 5, it almost did it. We didn't know. We posted a story last week. Honestly, had no idea what number one would be. Drake was slightly in the lead, but sometimes over the weekend when we get final streaming and airplay and sales, it can change a little bit. But he just held on one more week.
Yeah, and I at this point, it wouldn't have felt right to me for Girls Like You to be the song that unseated it, for it to be the kind of competition between these two songs, both of which are fading, and one of which just happens to be fading slightly faster than the other one.
Right.
I'd rather it be something new that kind of comes along and really takes the crown from Drake rather than just kind of inheriting it by default.
Well, so. it still could happen next week.
Sure.
So before
not done yet.
Yeah, but. Before you write off, you're filling in for Trevor perfectly on that. He doesn't like you at all. He doesn't think it's a worthy number one.
I don't think it is either. But that's partly it's a matter of what world you're living in. I'm sure if you're living in a more the mainstream focused, more radio focused world, and if you're living maybe. I don't know if you're a little bit older, maybe. I don't know what exactly the dividing line is, but there's clearly a world that Girls Like You has just totally been dominating the last two months or so. I mean, right. It's been like eight weeks at number one in radio, something like that. So, I mean, it's not like this is a nothing song. This is clearly a song that's having a very large impact. But in my world, on the internet, amongst the staff here, in the streaming world, it's a presence, but it's not one of those songs where you're just like, wow, like when is this song going to be over already? Like, enough. Like, I'm not sick of it yet, and I feel like the song that takes the crown from Drake should be a song that where it just like, man, like that was just an undeniable song. Like, they really earned that number one.
All right, I will proudly represent the older radio listening people among the staff here.
Are you sick of Girls Like You already, Gary?
I think it still sounds pretty fresh, actually. Okay. I think partly because it's so simple. It's not their most intricate melody hook that they've ever written, but those chords, they're just really
addictive.
And Cardi B is on it too. So if it gets there, Cardi B still gets a number one.
Yeah, no, and can't begrudge her that, certainly, but she's had two in the last calendar year. I think that's a decent representation for Cardi B on the Hot 100. And I'd rather see, we have some new songs in the top 20 this week, the top 10, than some songs that are kind of gaining very, very steadily behind it. And I'd like to see one of those songs, really, that really just kind of exerts its impact on the chart and feels like something fresher and newer than a song that's already been out for. I mean, the song itself without Cardi B has been out for even longer. So I think that it would feel more cathartic for those of us who have been in the weeds with Drake for so long to finally have a number one that feels like something new and interesting and different.
It's kind of like last year when Despacito fell for number one. It was Taylor Swift.
It took maybe the biggest recording artist of the decade to unseat it. And that's how I feel it should be this time.
Could be Killshot by Eminem.
Yeah,
so
sure.
Huge YouTube numbers so far. We're taping this on Wednesday, and we don't know where it'll debut yet, but could be top 10. Could challenge for number one. We'll see once we get more data.
Yeah, the interesting thing about Killshot to me is that everybody rushed to YouTube to listen to it.
Yeah, so we'll see. Eminem's obviously been making big news the last couple weeks, so maybe more to come from Eminem next week. But this week on the Hot 100. So Drake, number one again, a historic week. He passes Usher for the most weeks at number one in a year, 29 weeks at number one for Drake in 2018. God's Plan, 11 weeks. Nice for Watt, 8 weeks. And now 10 weeks. For In My Feelings. Usher had 28 weeks at number one in 2004, so Drake takes over.
Well.
All right, we're gonna talk about that. We talk about all these other years. We'll hear your memories, Andrew, of 2004.
Sure,
a couple other things for Drake this week. First solo artist with three songs that have topped the Hot 100 for at least 10 weeks each. So there's another record. 10 weeks at number one for In My Feelings. We just said 11 weeks at number one for God's Plan. And back in 2016, One Dance had 10 weeks. So no other soloist has ever done this. Boys to Men, the only other act in the 90s. They had to End of the Road, I'll Make Love to You, and One Sweet Day. So if those two records aren't enough, for Drake this week, he becomes the first soloist with two songs to lead the Hot 100 for at least 10 weeks each in the same year. So Feelings and God's Plan, both this year. The only other act, we're going back, Black Eyed Peas, 2009 for Boom Boom Pow, and I Get a Feeling.
Can't forget about those. My question for you about the three Drake number ones is, which of the three do you think will kind of go down as the biggest hit from this run? You know, let's say in theory that this is In My Feelings last week at number one, so it'd be 10 weeks and it's out. So is it God's Plan for having the 11 weeks? Is it Nice for What for having that big video? Is it In My Feelings for having the challenge? Which song would you say is the definitive Drake song from this period?
Yeah, I'm trying to really think this through, but I just keep coming back to really quickly. And I don't think it's just because we're in the moment now. Mm-hmm. I feel like it's In My Feelings. I feel like it just took over pop culture in a way that maybe we thought at the time God's Plan and Nice for What did, but doesn't it feel like In My Feelings totally outdid that?
Yeah, it sort of does. I think mostly because it kind of came out of nowhere. Like, the Drake song, God's Plan, when that first came out, it was like the return of Drake. He had taken, like 9 months off, which for him may as well be an entire decade. So it felt like a comeback single. And I think people were just excited to have him back because, he'd been silent for a little while. And then it felt like Nice for What was kind of riding the wave of that. But then, In My Feelings wasn't even a single at first. It was just one of the, 25 tracks on Scorpion. And it was sort of the elected single from the people, because first it was just the track that people were most into and quoting the lyrics and kind of making memes out of that, and then the challenge sort of developed seemingly organically. You never know what kind of influence Drake's people had on pushing the button with that, but it certainly seemed to snowball kind of on its own, whereas the other ones kind of dropped out of the sky as already sort of preordained number ones. This one kind of earned it on its own merit. So that I think that's probably why it feels like the biggest hit of the three. And I'm curious if it'll be the best enduring of the bunch, or if one of the others, kind of removed from the moment and the excitement of the meme and stuff like that will ultimately feel like the definitive Drake song. But I agree with you. I think that it seems like In My Feelings is probably the most likely candidate at this point.
And I think melodically, too, for pop fans who sometimes get into rap hits because there's maybe a good hook, it's got the most melodic chorus. I feel like everyone can just get into that. So it's got that extra element that I think God's Plan and Nice for What kind of has, but not as much.
Yeah, that's a fair point. Although Nice for What does have the benefit of sampling a kind of a proven pop classic, and I guess so does In My Feelings with that little lollipop bit at the end. So both indebted to chart history there, I suppose.
All right, so huge week for Drake. I guess we should mention, in just the interest of covering all angles, a great week on the charts, kind of a weird week for Drake on Twitter, pop culture
wise. I guess we can talk about that. I think Drake is getting some publicity for things maybe he wouldn't necessarily want to be getting publicity for. I don't know if you want to talk about the Millie Bobby Brown quote at the Emmys, but apparently she and he and Drake are text buddies. And what do they talk about? They talk about boys. I'll say the Emmy pre-show presenters at the time, I can't remember who they were, they seemed to think it was cute. They were like, oh, Drake, what a lovable thing that this celebrity is, kind of being buddy-buddy with you. But other people point out the age discrepancy between the two. I think he's 31, she's 14, maybe. Not the most appropriate pairing to have a texting relationship about romantic interests. There's been rumors of Drake dating a model who only just turned 18, but their relationship clearly goes back a couple of years. Is it a romantic relationship now? Was it then? We don't know. Hopefully we don't hear too much more about that in the days to come, unless there's something that we really need to hear about. But it's a period that. That hopefully doesn't last too much longer for Drake, and that we can, we can look back at this and that was a little bit weird, but at least nothing truly, truly untoward came about.
He's been pretty spotless when it comes to image, right? Unless I'm missing anything, it's always been he's just kind of this, in some ways, just kind of this robot who just keeps having one big hit after another.
Yeah, I mean, there's been plenty of drama there. Certainly, the feuds with Meek Mill and Kanye and Pusha T, and the "You're Hiding a Child" thing. It gets messy occasionally with Drake. But certainly he seems to be of that kind of Beyonce school of my brand is success, and I want to keep the focus on that as much as possible. So I imagine that even if and hopefully his relationships with these girls are totally clandestine and totally clean. But hopefully from here he kind of sees the blowback and sort of backs off a little bit at pursuing these perhaps too intimate relationships with teenage actresses and models and other folks from the celebrity world.
Yeah.
Or none.
Yeah. You know, yeah, no.
teenage girls have all stripes, really. Yeah, it's not like doing it with civilian teenage girls would be that much better. So
he's also reportedly suing a woman who apparently tried to extort money from him over apparently false pregnancy claims. This is, I guess, with all this other stuff, maybe this is just nothing to him. Apparently lost $200,000 in Atlantic City.
So, oh, really?
Yeah, like that's one of the highlights of his week.
That's one day's worth of Spotify royalties for Drake, I think. So he'll probably be all right there.
All right. So, yeah, he's a person.
He's not
just
that.
This person who puts out music. He's got other stuff. But we're talking about the charts mostly. Looking at Drake's 2018, looking at the chart numbers, we give you chart numbers all the time, but getting into the feel of what Drake's 2018 on the charts feels like historically when it comes to other acts who've had huge years on the Hot 100 over the years. Here's the really current reference I came up with, Andrew.
I'm very excited for this, Gary.
Hack Wilson, 1930, played for the Cubs. He set the record for 191 RBIs in the 1930 season. Yeah, I'm going back almost about 88 years, right, for this reference. Yeah. 191. It comes up sometimes among sports fans. You think, there's a record that maybe it's the greatest year in some ways by some measure, but you never really think about it. You think about greatest seasons. I think about Ted Williams, 1941, the Boston fan. Joe DiMaggio, I think he had a good year that year, too.
56 straight, yeah, sure.
You think of Mike Trout, current guys, you kind of think, you don't necessarily think of the one that set the record. So I was kind of curious, musically, where is this a year for Drake, 2018, where he set the record for most weeks at number one, 29? Where does it rank historically among other acts who've had these huge years? I'm going to come down on Hack Wilson now. Is it a Hack Wilson year where you don't think much about him? You sort of see that number. Or is it, this is totally, feels like one of the biggest years ever.
All right, well, did you want me to give kind of a baseball comp to that?
Is it going to be Philadelphia related?
No, I don't think it's going to be Philadelphia related. It's going to. I'm going to compare it to Barry Bonds going for 73 homers. Was that 2001? Was it?
Yeah.
Okay. In that, like Drake, Barry Bonds had already been a superstar for a very long time. I think back to the late '80s, even. Drake's not quite that long, but also Drake's stardom kind of dates back, I think, to the late aughts. It's been about a decade now.
2009.
It's not like. I think the reason why Hack Wilson maybe gets lost to history a little bit, and you could maybe throw in Roger Maris to this too, is that it was kind of his only historic season.
Right.
You know, I think he had a great career anyway. I'm pretty sure he was a Hall of Famer, but certainly if 88 years later, if you know one thing about Hack Wilson, it's this one RBI season. And also, we don't really talk about RBIs that much in general because it's not a very sabermetric-friendly stat. But that's a little bit too heavy into the baseball nerdery.
I just can't wait till I look at the analytics of this episode and I see the point where we started talking about Hack Wilson, where the listeners just totally go away.
But The other reason I mentioned Barry Bonds in this context is because it was a sort of a different era. It was an inflated era, and it was in Barry Bonds' case, it was a heavily artificially inflated era. And while I'm not accusing Drake of being a juicer by any means, these are different times in terms of these chart records, and we see them falling on an almost weekly basis these days. It feels like, just last year, obviously we had Despacito tying the 20-year record of Mariah Carey and Boyz II Men's One Sweet Day. Every week we have new records, it seems like, of most songs on the chart at once, longest stay in the top 10. You know, it feels like we're in a time where the numbers are kind of inflated. So does that mean that Drake's 29 weeks isn't the same as Usher's 28? I couldn't say that for sure. And we also don't know how much longer he still has to go. It could be in the 30s by the time we look back on the year. And it's still 3 months, three and a half months left. But it does feel like one of those records where it's like, wow, well, this shouldn't have been so easy. This shouldn't have come out. And then that's the other thing is that Barry Bonds ended up breaking the home run record by 12 after it hadn't even been touched for 40 years, I guess. 40 right. exactly, I think. So that also sort of feels weird that Drake broke it this early in the year with three songs that just kind of seem to go on unchallenged almost forever. So that's my baseball comparison. What do you have to say about that, Gary?
Yeah, I mean, it's always hard to compare eras when the methodology has been so different. Sure. At different times. In the early 2000s, when Usher was having all his number ones, the Hot 100 was basically a radio chart, because sales in that era between physical singles and before iTunes, the radio songs chart and the Hot 100 were almost completely the same chart. You could some weeks go 1 to 50 all the way down. There was no difference. So back then, you needed to be a huge radio act. Now, the way the chart is working with streaming so high, you need to be a big streaming act. So I think part of it, is the era in which you're charting. If Drake was having all these hits in 2004, maybe he wouldn't. He'd still be behind Usher, because maybe he wouldn't have been as big as radio. We don't know.
God's Plan, Nice for What, and In My Feelings all peaked at number 3 on radio songs, which is still very impressive, especially for a hip hop act, because hip hop still kind of has a love hate relationship with top 40 radio.
Right,
but that means that if this was 2004 and we were talking about the Hot 100 mostly as a radio chart, then it wouldn't be 29 weeks at number one. It'd be 0 weeks at number one, which is pretty crazy to think about.
Maroon 5 would be number one.
We were talking about Maroon 5 challenging a bunch of records at this point. Sure, yeah.
Different eras, obviously different metrics rule the charts, but perfect timing for Drake this year for streaming and the way it's working. So let's go back through some years over the Hot 100's history and see who's had other huge years.
Let's go digging in the vaults here.
All right, let's go before the Hot 100. Start with this guy.
You ain't nothing but a hound dog, girl. You're crying all the time. You ain't nothing but a hound dog, girl. Crying all the time.
Elvis Presley on the Billboard Sharpie podcast.
Heard him, yeah.
So before the Hot 100 even started in 1958, there were various charts that covered radio play, jukeboxes, sales back then, and on various charts before the Hot 100. In 1956, Elvis had 25 weeks at number one combined before the Hot 100. So he's in this discussion. We don't want to exclude Elvis from that. Heartbreak Hotel, Don't Be Cruel, Hound Dog, Love Me Tender, all 1956. Years later now, to talk about impact of some of these artists later, Elvis, he's had pretty good impact.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to compare Drake to Elvis for any number of reasons. I mean, obviously, pre-Hot 100, the chart system was totally different. But yeah, you're talking about certainly one of the greatest years that anybody's ever had, and sort of a defining year for everything that kind of came after it. I mean, when you talk about the concept of rock stardom, period, you're basically talking about Elvis Presley in 1956. And you look at these songs, I mean, like Elvis had, 17 number one hits from the rock era?
If you combine different charts.
Yeah, and you look at some of them now, and, I Want You, I Need You, I Love You, or Surrender, or like a couple of these other ones that I couldn't sing for you. I think a lot of people my age probably aren't totally familiar with.
Right.
These are big songs. I mean, Heartbreak Hotel, even if you don't know the song, you know that phrase. You've heard other songs that have referenced it. Hound Dog, certainly one of the most famous songs in rock history. Love Me Tender, still like a kind of a banner slow song. And then Don't Be Cruel, which I think was the longest running of all of these, really. You're not going to do much better than that. That's about as big a year as you'll ever have in popular music, especially because everybody in the world, I'm sure, had heard of Elvis Presley and had an opinion about Elvis Presley. I'm sure the generational divides about what that opinion actually was. But, I'm sure there's people in this country that don't know Drake. I don't think there was anybody in 1956 who didn't know who Elvis Presley was. Yeah. I feel like we should almost leave Elvis as his own thing in this. Like maybe you name the Hall of Fame after Elvis, but you don't actually include him in the inductions because it just doesn't feel – it was such a different thing back then. It doesn't feel right to compare him to some of these other acts.
She loves you, yeah, yeah, yeah.
So we started with Elvis. I think we're setting a really high bar when you go into the Beatles, sure. 1964. After that, so 18 weeks at number one in 1964 for the Beatles on the Hot 100. I Want to Hold Your Hand, She Loves You, Can't Buy Me Love, Love Me Do, Hard Day's Night, and I Feel Fine. It's a record, 6 number ones in a year. No one else has ever done that. So Drake, he's at 3, only 3 number ones in 2018. Just the overall impact. Neither of us were born in 1964, yes, but we've seen the news clips. We've seen YouTube. Beatles were pretty big in 64.
Yeah, so I hear. And this was also the year that they had the entirety of the top 5, just all Beatles songs, right?
Right, yeah. April 4th, 1964.
And I think that those two records standing for over half a century, that's, I think even more so than Elvis. I mean, and the Beatles, I think, are probably the only other act in the rock era that you can sort of compare to Elvis in terms of that level of just absolute hysteria. Those two records combined with the movie of Hard Day's Night and the album of Hard Day's Night, and the fact that they were still releasing other singles that weren't even connected to that movie or album, and just basically from one end of the year to the other, it was Beatlemania. It was as culturally immersive as a musical act will probably get in not in our lifetime, because we weren't around for it, but in the Hot 100 era.
As we're taping this, a guy named Paul McCartney is number one on the Billboard 200.
First time in 36 years. First time
in 36 years. So when you talk about lasting impact, not that we needed a new Paul McCartney album to go to number one to realize, Beatles are still pretty well known.
Still kind of a thing, yeah.
Still kind of shows that the appetite for new music from a Beatle in 2018 is obviously still there.
You know, we're getting further away from the point where the Beatles are kind of the unquestioned greatest artists of the rock era, because, you know, rock music is sort of falling out of vogue. And, you know, I think more people these days, more artists these days, will talk about a guy we're going to talk about pretty shortly as kind of the paragon of pop success. And there's an argument to be made, certainly. But in the 60s, for a very long time afterwards, the Beatles were the gold standard, and in many ways they still are.
And as original fans get older, at the same time, we have YouTube, we have Spotify now. So young kids.
We have Beatles Rock Band.
Beatles Rock Band. So everyone can still discover the Beatles as if they're brand new. So it's kind of, everything's kind of era-less.
For sure.
Nowadays. Moving on to the 70s. You think about the 70s, not sure anyone quite had the pinnacle that the Bee Gees did in 1977, 78. So it was actually 1 week at the end of 77 into 78. They had 15 weeks at number one with How Deep Is Your Love, Staying Alive, and Night Fever. Did disco make the Bee Gees, or did the Bee Gees make disco?
I think it was just good timing and good placement for all concerned. I think disco was already a force for several years at that point. Like, I can't remember what Rock the Boat went number one in like 74 maybe.
Yeah.
I think. So clearly disco was already a burgeoning phenomenon. But it really wasn't just the Bee Gees, as I'm sure you're about to know yourself. Like it was kind of the Gibb brothers in general, and Andy Gibb also doing his own solo stuff, and Barry Gibb writing for Yvonne Elliman, and Saturday Night Fever the movie. It was just, you know, when you think of 77, you think of punk rock in the UK, and you think of disco in the US, and the Bee Gees just had the market cornered, basically.
Kind of an example, too. You talk about how we're saying it's such a great thing for these artists who had these huge years. Bee Gees are probably the biggest example we're going to look at here of an act who had the biggest brushback afterwards because of disco. I don't think any other sound has had that kind of backlash that disco did, and at the same time, the Bee Gees.
Sure, yeah, and I think you can make a very, very accurate and strong argument that they never quite got the credit they deserved as innovators, as songwriters, as performers, and as just kind of greats of their time. Because, as you said, the disco backlash was so extreme in the early 80s, and there's sort of this consensus agreement among the powers that be in the rock world to just sort of pretend like that time never happened, or it happened, but it was something regrettable. But the songs from that period have endured incredibly well. How Deep Is Your Love, If I Can't Have You, certainly all of Staying Alive. These are iconic songs, beyond iconic songs. And for a long time, I think the Saturday Night Fever soundtrack was the greatest selling album of all time. I remember hearing a story about how the next guy we're going to talk about would listen to it, repeatedly on headphones, and just try to internalize the lessons of it and kind of get into the DNA of it, because that was the absolute gold standard for success at that time.
Disco itself, I remember working in AC radio in the late 90s, and we started having these way back Wednesdays. This was even before Throwback Thursday as a thing.
Flashback Fridays. You almost have the entire week there.
Memory Mondays. Now we just need a Tuesday.
We can work on that. We can come back to that one.
It was about 20 years it took for these songs to be played on even AC radio, and they've never left since. Mm-hmm. So it sort of 20 years of exile, and then ever since, 20 years of they're solid hits again. People appreciate it. So I think it comes down to the songs themselves. They're really good.
Great songs.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
So Michael Jackson, you were alluding to before that, 14 weeks at number one in 1983, and actually 16 weeks if you extend it into 84 with Billie Jean, Beat It. And when you say as a part of that, it sort of stands out. Wait, that's not on the same level as Billie Jean. Well,
and not on the same album as those two either.
Right. So, yeah. But yeah, Michael Jackson's 83, obviously Thriller, running all that. And you know, interesting, same kind of thing with disco a little bit. There was a time for quite a while when Michael Jackson wasn't thought of as just this iconic king of pop. He was in the 80s. I think after that, and all the various allegations that came out in the 90s, his image took a huge hit. I think it was after he died, people just decided to focus on the music. And ever since then, the last 9 years or so, he's gone back up to that unquestionable, for the most part, just pop icon level that I think we've thought of since.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, it's not the same thing as it was with the Gibbs, where, you know, Michael's music never really fell out of vogue. I mean, you know, there was that time in the 90s where there was that kind of apocryphal moment almost where Nirvana knocked Michael Jackson off the charts and that kind of symbolic takeover of the Billboard 200 in early 92. And so I guess for a while there, as part of the kind of the 90s alternative era where it was more rock and cred and like, you know, grungy dourness, maybe Michael's music wasn't totally the in vogue. But, you know, he still had number one hits during then. He still had iconic videos. It was really his personal life and some of the controversies and the allegations that you mentioned that sort of turned the tide on him in a non-favorable way. And his own kind of larger-than-life largesse and his untouchability, that there was a time when that wasn't really seen as being a good thing. And then, yeah, as you say, when he died, like it was just like a switch flipped on him. I couldn't believe it at the time. Not that it wasn't deserved in some ways. I think a lot of the backlash against him was overstated. But yeah, now MJ is MJ forever, right. And he is on that untouchable level again, as the Beatles, as Elvis. He's absolutely up there, and today I think, as I said, my most artists would be considered as the greatest of all time in terms of pop music.
And so Elvis in 1956, you know, in some ways really starting the rock era, mm-hmm. almost single-handedly, and in some ways the Beatles in 1964 bringing pop music to just a level it hadn't been. It had been a lot of still some of the big bands were still big before then, so 1964 changed everything. 1983, Michael Jackson, he brought R&B music really to MTV. It was mm-hmm. very transformative in a similar way, even though he'd been out for over a decade. This really changed everything.
Well, this was sort of going to be my big question to you, is that so obviously the Beatles 1964 is kind of the pinnacle of the British Invasion. Bee Gees in 1977 is the pinnacle of disco. Michael Jackson in 1983, I think, is the pinnacle of MTV, of the early MTV era.
Yeah.
Are we going to remember Drake's 2018 as the pinnacle of the early streaming era?
It's weird when you say that, because all the other elements we just mentioned feel very communal in a way. And when you talk about it, when you say the streaming era, I just think someone with their headphones on in their own world, it doesn't feel the same way, does it?
Well, but it's still people being connected. You know, you're right that it's not everyone crowding around a TV to watch the Beatles on Ed Sullivan or to watch the Thriller video, but it's people sharing links, it's people sharing memes, it's a viral thing that's still communal. It's just a less physically communal thing as opposed to now it's more of a more digitally communal. And that's still important.
I think you're right. I think when we think of 2010s streaming. I think we will come back to Drake.
Yeah, he's sort of the guy for that period. And the other thing that's interesting to me, is that I guess with the sort of the exception of Michael Jackson, most of these other artists are sort of kind of at the outset of their superstardom. You know, Elvis, I think his first single was 54, 55. Beatles, I think, officially debuted in 62. Bee Gees, I guess, had been around for a while, but they hadn't been disco until 75, I think, was Jive Talking, maybe.
Yeah.
So that was still relatively new into all their runs. Drake's been Drake forever. I mean, Drake's been Drake since at least 2009 and even before that, really. So that's what makes this peak so staggering, is that it felt like he had already hit his peak several times already. And I think you guys have talked about this on the podcast before, but how it felt like for a long time, when Hotline Bling only peaked at number two and it got shut off by Adele, a lot of people thought, well, that was his chance. And now he missed it. And now maybe he'll never have a number one. And here we are later. And now we're saying, will Drake ever not be number one? Yeah. It's pretty crazy.
Moving on to the 90s, maybe some of us forget how big R&B was.
Sure.
Early into mid-90s, Boyz II Men. So they had 17 weeks at number one in 1994. Maybe we're at the first act who doesn't quite have the same lasting legacy, and who mm-hmm. really does when you talk about Elvis, Beatles, maybe Bee Gees, Michael Jackson.
It was almost like a handing off of the baton from Boyz II Men to Mariah Carey via One Sweet Day for a long time, the longest running number one song in history. As a very young person at the time, someone was just starting to get into pop music. Nobody was bigger than those acts. That they were, the CDs you would see in everybody's collection, even if they weren't really that big of a music fan. And they were the videos that were always topping countdowns on MTV. In 1996, certainly Mariah Carey, between Always Be My Baby and Fantasy and One Sweet Day, she was the definitive MTV star of that period. It does feel sort of out of step today, where we don't have those kind of R&B stars that are just sort of dominating both the charts and pop culture in such a way. But at the time, it was the commercially dominant music for sure.
Yeah. So she had 26 weeks at number one, 95, 96 combined. I know for most of these stats, we're talking just January to December, but you can't mention all this without mentioning the run that Mariah has is a half a year at number one, just months wise. And same thing. I remember at the time how big a deal it was that Boyz II Men and Mariah were on a song together. And I knew One Sweet Day was going to be number one just for such a long time because of that.
It's pretty incredible. Yeah. And then we may as well get into the next artist, because he was kind of the guy who turned the corner on that when Puff Daddy sort of became the biggest star in hip hop following the death of Notorious B.I.G. and the posthumous success that he had with his Life After Death album. And then he kind of set the new standard for rap on MTV in a way that was mind blowing at the time. These epic videos and these event singles that sampled other hits from the past and sort of built on them. And he basically took rap to new commercial heights that I'd never quite seen before, with the entire Bad Boy family in tow, and Notorious B.I.G. and Mace and all the R&B acts that appear on the same songs as them. That was sort of the natural evolution there at the time.
I'm sort of feeling a parallel with 2018 and 1997, where Puff Daddy was number one for 19 weeks. And you had these little pockets of pop that snuck in from Hanson and sure. Spice Girls, kind of like how this year there's been a little Ed Sheeran, little Camila Cabello, kind of similar, right? In terms of just rap is king and a little bit of pop here and there making its way.
Yeah, and it's funny because you really didn't see that on the charts before 97, at least not with these Hot 100 hits that would just last forever, it seems like. And it felt like rap was already sort of a pretty important commercial force at the time. And growing up, I thought that Dr. Dre and Snoop Dogg were the biggest thing in the world, but they never got to number one on their own, at least not before Puff Daddy did. And he kind of blew the doors open, and it's been hip hop's field ever since.
Nelly, 2002 with Hot in Here, and Dilemma, 17 weeks at number one. Are we maybe hitting an act who is a little bit more in the league of, they kind of had that one big moment as opposed to, we're talking about someone who can compare with, again, with Elvis and the Beatles.
Sure. And for me, it wasn't a year for Nelly. It was a summer. When I think of summer, I still think of Nelly 2002.
You're drilling it down even to a season.
Yeah. I don't know how closely it lines up to the summer months, that 17-week run. Maybe a little bit was in spring, maybe a little bit was in autumn. Who knows? But That was like my last year of going to like a summer camp type program, and the sound of it was Nelly and the Neptunes, and that is how I'll always define when you think of like Song of the Summer, and that's a discussion we have every year. For me, the Song of the Summer is and always will be Hot in Here.
Yeah.
And then, I mean, obviously that's hot in the title, that helps, but it was so massive and it was so beloved that it felt like it should have been huge in the summer. And Dilemma's hat was the other side, whereas, you know, as opposed to like the party jam, that was the kind of the puppy love, oh, right, summer romance sort of jam. And I don't think you can ask for two better summer songs than that. And the fact that they were number one back to back forever, you know, that feels like the way it should have been, and never again afterwards.
And thanks for filling in for Trevor perfectly by making it very clear you were really young in
the 2000s. I think Trevor was well younger than I was, but I was still a teenager at the time, certainly.
All right. 2003 for Beyoncé, 17 Weeks with Crazy in Love. Baby Boy, it kind of feels, looking back, if you look at the track history, and just kind of feels like she was, a bad pun, destined, your sure. destiny to, yeah. to be such a big solo star. But it kind of felt like we knew right from the start that, yep, she kind of is meant to be solo.
Yeah, I was sort of... tuned out at that point in time. I was not as pop conversant as I am now, or I was before. I was sort of going through like an indie phase at the time. So the Beyonce thing kind of took me by surprise. I had stopped paying attention to Destiny's Child, and I wasn't aware that this kind of reckoning was coming, where Beyonce was going to come and announce her presence to the pop world in such a dramatic way. But yeah, Crazy in Love, I remember even the indie snobs I was hanging out with at the time, they loved that song. And it was the same sort of thing with Nelly, where like the summer was just owned by Beyonce. It was sort of those two songs, and then like Hey, I kind of took it home from there for the rest of 2003. But those were big songs and kind of expanding the entire music listening universe into being pop fans.
So you were this rebellious, snobby teen?
Rebellious is strong, but I was snobby, yes.
What were you listening to then? What was 2003?
2003. I was very big into the Rapture and the kind of underground New York disco punk movement, early LCD Sound System, Chick Chick Chick, bands like that, and the Strokes, Interpol, stuff like that too. And Radiohead obviously was the most acclaimed band of that era. Wilco, I don't know, a lot of underground rock music from that time, I guess.
Well, I know you as a pop guy, so I feel like this is a very brief period in your musical
history. Well, it's funny. Like I used to be, I've told people this before, my kind of evolution as being a music writer is that I used to be the pop guy at indie publications, and then I became sort of the indie guy at pop publications. So, yeah, there you go.
All right. 2004, Usher, that's the one we keep talking about. His 2004, so four number ones, 28 weeks in 2004. Any thoughts off the top of your head of which one is bigger now that they both have the top two?
So Usher, 2004, that was my senior year of high school. I think, yeah, it was probably the biggest song at our senior prom. I mean, like that, all my friends were super into Usher at the time. This was me getting back into pop music in the biggest way possible. And Usher was the guy from that year. And you know, you don't really think of him as being on the same kind of iconic level as Michael Jackson or Madonna or Prince or even, yeah, you know, the Beatles and Elvis, people like that. I don't know if I could totally explain why that is, because he was as big as those artists for this year, and it wasn't just one song either. It was four different songs that went to number one off that album, and they had massive videos, and he was a triple threat entertainer, could sing, could dance, could write a little bit. Like he was as big as aughts pop music gets. But maybe it's because the next album didn't quite take off in the same way, or maybe it's because even as he was kind of, blazing his own trail, it still felt kind of echoey of Michael Jackson in a way. It didn't feel like he was doing something, totally new. He was working with some newer producers, some newer songwriters. He was the sound of aughts music, working with the Neptunes and Lil Jon and all the kind of biggest producers of the time.
Maybe that's kind of a Bee Gees thing. It was maybe a little too tied to its time to last after that.
Yeah, maybe. Or just maybe the songs weren't quite on the level of those MJ songs, or... I don't know, maybe it's just a different era commercially. Maybe by 2004, things had gotten so fragmented, you just couldn't have a Thriller again. I don't know, but I'm still an Usher guy. I'll go to bat for Usher. And I got to be honest, I was hoping a little bit that Drake got interrupted in week 27. I feel like Drake, he's gonna have plenty of records before all said and done. I liked Usher getting a hold on to that one, but I was also rooting against Despacito last year, so maybe I'm just old-fashioned in this regard.
Interesting, too, we were talking about before, you mentioned of when... in their careers, these acts have these years. Usher, he was about 7 years or so into his career at this point. Drake now about a decade in. So there's Elvis starting at 56, Beatles 64, coming out of the gate pretty much with these huge years. But then people like Usher and Drake and Mariah in 95, 96, mm-hmm. same kind of thing where it makes sense just in a different way. You can come out and be the biggest thing and just capture attention. But the other angle is a few years in, you've built up your fan base. You've built up kind of in steps a little bit more gradually. And then you put out that thriller yep. type album where suddenly everything comes together. You have the fan base. And so there's different ways to do it.
Yeah. And I really do have a soft spot for those artists that just kind of own an entire year. They just start early on February, March, whatever, and they just kind of carry it all the way through. And then there's something romantic about that to me. Maybe it's because I'm a sports fan too. And you like thinking of things in terms of years and seasons. But the fact that you say Usher 2004, anybody in the pop world will know exactly what you're talking about. And then that's meaningful to me.
2004 was a good year for Boston sports fans.
Oh, yeah, I heard about that too. That's a big one.
2009, Black Eyed Peas, two huge songs, 26 weeks at number one. So that's the third longest run at number one in a year, 26 weeks. They still have the record for longest continuous run. This was back to back. So for six straight months.
For a group too, I'm sure.
Yeah, it was Black Eyed Peas. So 26 weeks with Boom Boom Pow, and I got a feeling, and saying all those records, I still come back to. They just don't have the track record of someone like Michael Jackson or the Beatles or anyone else. And it was they've had another number one hit with I'm a B. They've had hits before that with Justin Timberlake. So they've got a great catalog. It just kind of feels like these two songs just kind of overshadowed anything else they've ever done. And because in some ways they haven't followed it up since then, it feels a little bit of an outlier among some of these other years.
Yeah, it's hard to put your finger on exactly what makes this one feel so weird in retrospect. But they were always kind of a goofy act.
Yeah,
like and they don't take themselves as seriously as some of these other artists on this list, and they don't have the kind of critical respectability of a lot of them. And yeah, they feel very 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 much of their time. Certainly, like these songs are about as big as any of their era, and then they sort of define them in a lot of ways. But they remind people of probably some parts of their lives and of music history that maybe they're not so fond of. Maybe they don't would rather not remember. And they sort of kickstart this sort of pop rap moment in time, which also encompasses LMFAO and Pitbull, maybe Kesha to a certain extent. And that actually ends up being incredibly influential on the course of popular music. But it doesn't have a lot to do with the kind of things we're listening to in 2018.
Yeah.
Rap these days is a lot more, it's a lot more streaming focused. It's a lot more about, these young street rappers and people that, aren't goofy dudes just singing about partying every day. And so this I think is also kind of that Bee Gees thing where, maybe 10 years from now, we'll look back and be like, wow, like Will I Am, like he just owned that entire period. And Fergie with her solo success. And it'll seem more impressive and less ridiculous. But that probably a lot of people looked at Barry Gibb in 1989 the way that we look at Will.i.am and Fergie now. So,
Interesting to me, I think, because the songs were so different. I think when you think of Black Eyed Peas, I like how you said they kind of had this quirky sound.
Sure.
You think Where Is the Love, kind of their core sound. Boom Boom Pow is just really weird in the sparse, rappy kind of way. And then I got a feeling I think people, if they know enough about it, they think it's a David Guetta song. So it's kind of like neither song fully represents who they were. So I think it just kind of it's more these two songs themselves as opposed to maybe a Black Eyed Peas overall. Yeah.
But they had a lot going on. They were legitimately ahead of their time, maybe not like 2008 ahead of their time, but they were ahead of their time. Right. And they predicted a lot of where music was going. But the combination of some of the more goofy lyrics and the fashion choices and the two members of the group where nobody really knew what they did, like it's just easy to kind of look back and laugh. And not acknowledge that they had some songs, no doubt.
Greetings, loved ones. Let's take a journey.
Where the grass is really greener. 19 weeks, Katy Perry, number one on the Hot 100, 2010 and 2011. So five number ones from Teenage Dream, which still a record, tied Michael Jackson's five number ones from Bad. Now, we were talking about Thriller before. What an afterthought Bad is. The guy had five number ones from an album. We don't even mention it because the Thriller was so huge.
And also Bad divided unevenly across 87 to 88. So right. It's hard to say it was one year that MJ sort of dominated. Yeah.
Katy Perry, huge time. So record setting, five number ones. You're talking about that happy music in late 2000s, early 2010s that just we're not hearing that much of now. This was really the heights of the Max Martin era pop, NSYNC, Britney, and Backstreet Boys had started all that about a decade before. But Katy Perry kind of took that to just historic levels at this point. She's never had this kind of run again. But I put this in that league of no one was bigger than Lady Gaga, but she didn't have the same chart success that Katy Perry did in terms of Hot 100 number ones from one album.
For sure. I would say Lady Gaga was the bigger star of the period. Taylor Swift was certainly the biggest seller of the period. But when you talk about the kind of the end of radio's imperial era as released at the Hot 100, Katy Perry is basically the last true megastar in terms of just you put it out and it's going to be a hit. And in this case, it was five of them went to number one. And unlike with Michael Jackson, where you kind of look back and you're like, yeah, were all those songs really? And then in the case of Katy Perry, at least three of those songs are still considered iconic pop songs.
Which three?
Teenage Dream, California Girls, and Firework.
Yeah, the first three.
And I maybe it drops off a little bit for the last two, E.T. And Last Friday Night. But those were still those were legitimately big hits. I think they're remembered mostly fondly. E.T.'s a little goofy, but whatever.
But she kind of had to switch things up. She could just couldn't keep putting out the same. So maybe she could have, but it helped to kind of just switch things up.
Sure, but this legitimately was the biggest period in Katy Perry's career. It was as big as anybody got in radio at that time. And you mentioned Max Martin. There's another name that it's a little bit less comfortable to mention these days, but Dr. Luke was also a primary architect of this period. And his falling out of favor, both sonically and obviously in terms of public perception with the Kesha trial and some of the allegations raised against him, that sort of makes this era feel especially far away in retrospect. But at the time, this was pop music. This was as big as it got.
Uh-oh, we're going from Katy Perry to...
'Cause baby, now we got bad blood. You know it used to be mad love. So take a look what you've done. 'Cause baby, now we got bad blood. Hey, now we got problems.
This is Taylor.
Shake It Off, Blank Space, and there's Bad Blood, Taylor Swift, 12 weeks at number one over 2014 to 15. Again, Taylor was about a decade into her career. I'm going to compare Taylor with the Bee Gees. This was maybe the two biggest examples of acts who really changed their sound and wound up with huge chart success.
Sure. I mean, with Taylor, it was more of a steady evolution. You can track... it was very incremental. Every album got a little bit poppier, and eventually she ended up at this kind of blockbuster pop mold. The Bee Gees, there were a couple dramatic left turns in there that, I don't think you listen to those early albums and think there's any way they're eventually going to get to Saturday Night Fever. And Taylor Swift, I think we remember this more as a period of cultural dominance than as a period of chart dominance. 12 weeks is a lot, but it's not, some of these songs, like I Got a Feeling was number one for longer than 12 weeks entirely on its own. Really stunning about Taylor's 1989 period was how long she was at number one. It was just how long she was around.
Right.
Like this album lasted for what it felt maybe like 30 months total, which is insane. And we talked about it a bunch when we were talking about our, we did that podcast celebrating the 30th anniversary of Michael Jackson's Bad, where in the late 80s, you would have albums that would start kind of slowly but ramp up, and before you knew it, they were on singles number six or seven, and they were still massive hits. And this is kind of the only album, 1989, in the last decade that sort of feels like that, where there wasn't – it didn't start off on top, and then it just kind of gradually dissipated from there. It's just like, no, this was in the culture forever.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's a good point, because looking at all these years, and this one kind of hit me the same way that, oh, yeah, we were talking about Elvis and the Beatles and Michael Jackson, and, you get to Nelly and Usher, it just doesn't feel like that same overall pop culture domination that I put Taylor Swift in that everyone knew who she was.
Yeah, there was a period where it was like, where Taylor Swift was sort of on that Beyonce level of, like, how dare you say anything negative about this wonderful person that we all love. The beginning of the 1989 run was sort of the peak of that, and it was about as universal an approval rating, and again, not just from critics, not just from East Coast, West Coast pop fans, but Heartland listeners, radio listeners, streaming listeners. There's nobody in the world that Taylor Swift didn't touch in some way.
Drake, 2016. We're talking about his 2018. He was huge in 2016. He had 19 weeks at number one. Obviously, Work. He was featured on Work by Rihanna, but with his own One Dance. Now this feels totally overshadowed.
Yeah, absolutely. And it felt weird at the time, even because even if, as it was having this kind of dramatic run of success, Drake himself was taking a lot of beatings on the internet, like and critically and from, you know, just kind of in casual conversation. A lot of people didn't really like the Views as an album. You know, it was too long. It kind of flowed weirdly. There were a bunch of really like clunky lyrics on it. And like Hotline Bling was kind of tacked on at the end for no reason, maybe just to boost streams. And One Dance, I mean, people like that song, but I don't remember that song as one of those like, oh, everybody just goes nuts when this song comes on sort of songs. It was more just like, yeah, it's Drake. He's the biggest artist. This is his biggest song. Okay.
Well, it kind of felt like Hotline Bling, we're saying, got to number two before that. It kind of felt like this was sort of the makeup call.
It's yeah. Kind of like, all right, yeah, makeup calls go away.
But here's the number one. But it felt like Hotline Bling to this day still feels bigger.
I would agree with that.
So that's Drake. We'll do one more year.
Come and move that in my direction. So thankful for that. It's such a blessing, yeah. Turn every situation into heaven, yeah. Oh, you are.
Justin Bieber's 2017. So a week at number one with On the One. And then 16 weeks Despacito. And he was featured on both of them. But you could argue that Despacito isn't the hit that it became without Bieber. And in some ways, maybe this isn't as big as his 2015-16. It really kickstarted. I think with no What Do You Mean and Sorry and Love Yourself, there's no 2017 Bieber. But you combine all that, 2015-17, and then he kind of just stepped back for the most part since then. That's a pretty historic run he had for those few years.
Yeah, and this is my favorite kind of year that a pop star can have, where you dominate pop music without a single one of your own songs.
Right.
And Rihanna kind of did the same thing that year. I think I did like a little Justin Bieber and Rihanna recap at the end of the year, where I was like, every month one of them was on a song or had a big video or was doing something to kind of, you know, keep their stardom running, even as they were releasing none of their own music, really. You know, Rihanna was on, you know, they're both on DJ Khaled songs. And then obviously Justin Bieber was on Despacito. And like, this is kind of the ultimate flex of one's pop superstardom, in my opinion, is can you still run the culture without even releasing any of your own music? And then right. Those are two of the only seven people on the planet who could do that, maybe.
All right. So Drake now, 2018. So looking at all those years, just lasting impact. And we started with Elvis and the Beatles. I'm not sure anyone really comes to those levels since. And, you know, being in 2018 now, Drake is still number one. I'm not sure it's fair to even assess what the influence is. We won't know going forward until maybe a few years from now.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. I think if you look at this list, it's Elvis, the Beatles, and Michael Jackson. I think those are the names that just kind of stand out as all-timers, untouchable, and at their very peak of popularity, at their very peak of cultural influence. Maybe at their peak artistically, you can argue that with the Beatles one way or the other, but most people, and, you know, Michael Jackson, maybe some people prefer Off the Wall even, but you know, it certainly, when you talk about what does everybody compare themselves to, like, oh, they're as big as Elvis, they're as big as the Beatles, they're as big as Michael Jackson, like, right. Those are the names you would mention. Although it's interesting, you know, you want to talk about a couple artists that aren't mentioned here at all?
Yeah, sure.
I'll try to do it quickly, but the other one, big as, you know, you would fill in the blank there, is probably Madonna.
Right.
And she doesn't really have that one year, that one run. But it's more a sustained thing over the course of two decades.
I was going to say Madonna, Elton John, you put in that.
Sure.
Billy Joel, Prince, Whitney Houston, yeah. Janet Jackson, all these acts. Rihanna as well.
Sure,
maybe
sure.
Maroon 5 this decade that, yeah, we could obviously talk about them, but it's, as you say, more consistent, more always there, maybe never one huge year.
Yeah. And I do have to give it up for Prince in 84. Obviously, you know, with Purple Rain and a couple of the number one hits there, and still writing for Chaka Khan and for Sheena Easton. Like, the 84 Prince is, you know, it might not make there by chart, but I think that's one of those years that you remember. And the other one I wanted to mention is 2002 Eminem, where he has the Eminem Show and Without Me and Cleaning Out My Closet, a couple of big singles off of that. And then he also has 8 Mile and Lose Yourself, which is a 12-week number one. He eventually wins an Oscar for it. It might not quite line up Hot 100 wise, but
right.
In terms of you know, superstars at their absolute peak, it's pretty hard to argue with those two either.
And now you're making me think you could put Adele,
2011,
for sure. 2012 Absolutely. In there, although she had a longer run at number one with Hello, the other songs before that. There's so many more we could probably think about, probably. But these are just in terms of chart years, people who did have the longest runs, and now Drake. He's on top of that list. So we just wanted to kind of look at chart numbers versus what it maybe just kind of feels like impact-wise.
And I think these things never feel as significant when you're actually living through them.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's entirely possible 10 years from now we're looking back on this and being like, man, that was one of the great runs too. And we'll have to see. We'll have to – you know, is he Michael Jackson or is he the Bee Gees? We'll have to wait to see where popular music goes from here to probably know the answer to that.
The heart is stronger than you think, like it can go through anything. Even when you think you can't find a way, I still push on, no. Sometimes you want to run away.
All right, wrapping things up here on the podcast this week, flashing back to a little piece of that song we just heard. That's Just Stand Up by, it was billed to Artist Stand Up to Cancer, talking about it here for a flashback this week, 10 years ago today. If you're listening to this podcast when it posts here on the September 20th, 2008, this got up to its number 11 peak on the Billboard Hot 100. You look at the lineup on this song. This is, we're talking about all these superstars we were just talking about here on the podcast.
Yeah, a whole bunch of them.
People on this song, run them down real quick. Mariah, Beyonce, Mary J. Blige, Rihanna, Fergie, Sheryl Crow, Melissa Etheridge, Natasha Bedingfield, Miley Cyrus, Leona Lewis, Carrie Underwood, Keisha Cole, Leanne Rimes, Ashanti, and Ciara. All coming to Ciara or Ciara?
I've heard both. I think Ciara is the preferred pronunciation, right. But I've heard both.
So a superstar charity song for Stand Up to Cancer. Superstar writers and producers. Babyface co-wrote it, produced it with L.A. Reid. So all the success they've had over the years came together for this song. Spearheaded by Mariah. Originally, Celine Dion and Whitney Houston, too, although then some things got worked around. And only Mariah was on the final version. I like this tidbit. Apparently, Matthew Knowles bid $500,000 for Beyonce to sing more lines than anyone else on the song. Great, obviously, for charity and just absolute superstar vocals. It still sounds great years later.
It was a better song than I remembered listening to it again. It sounded like one of those kind of acoustic Stargate numbers that Rihanna was doing a bunch of at the time.
Yeah.
I feel like, you know, if you stripped away the celebrity cast and just had it as an album track on the second half of like Good Gone Bad or one of those Rihanna albums at the time, I probably would have dug it.
Yeah, a little irreplaceable.
Yeah,
about
sure.
It. Same kind of sound. It was a number 11 hit on the Hot 100. Got some airplay, too. It was an airplay hit on AC and Adult Top 40, which you don't always see for some of these charity singles. It's not really, they're not really meant for radio. Mm-hmm. They're meant so people buy them and proceeds go towards them. So it was sort of a bonus that it got any airplay at all. But
no doubt, yeah.
A good song. So 10 years later, if you were to do a song like this, who would still be in that lineup?
I actually did a little homework before doing this. So I got the list of the artists as they appear on the song, and I tried to figure out A, would they still be on the song today?
Yeah.
And B, if they weren't, who would do their version?
Yeah.
So the first three performers are Beyonce, Carrie Underwood, and Rihanna.
Yeah.
Those are the first three in performing order. I think those are all still on the song. None of those three artists have been replaced by like newer models.
I was going to say those are my three absolute yes, yeah, they no come doubt. Back.
Miley Cyrus, I don't think so. I think Miley Cyrus, her presence is distracting these days. I think Ariana Grande plays her part now.
I was going to say Ariana maybe is my top choice for first person in from 2018.
No doubt. Then Sheryl Crow, who actually, did you ever watch the live version of this? Like the one they actually performed?
Yeah.
So Sheryl Crow wasn't on that version. They had Nicole Scherzinger of the Pussycat Dolls instead, which is a little strange. But I think you want someone for this slot to be someone who's a little bit more in that singer-songwriter mold. I think they ask Taylor Swift first. I think she says no. I think they ask Adele after that. I think she says no too. And then I think they get to Pink. I think she says yes.
Oh, Pink.
Yeah.
I like that.
Maybe Kelly Clarkson instead, but one of those two probably.
So Taylor and Adele, are they just, they're too big to play with others at this point?
Too big, too conflicting schedules. Maybe they're still on tour elsewhere. Maybe they have their own charity singles that they're working on.
Yeah.
But I feel like those are the people that they put the ask out to and then, you know, just doesn't come together for whatever reason. Fergie, I think, is now Camila Cabello. Leona Lewis, I think, is now Dua Lipa. I think that makes sense. Keisha Cole had a little trouble with this. I think now it's Jennifer Hudson. I think also in 2008 it should have been Jennifer Hudson. I'm not sure how she was not involved with
this. I was going to say in terms of just pure vocalists.
Yeah,
how
sure.
could she not be on? And Dua Lipa, same thing. I feel like she is maybe one of the best new vocalists just in terms of
she's
actual vocalists.
Sure.
Yeah.
The Natasha Bedingfield role, I think, is a battle to the death between Bebe Rexha and Rita Ora. I think Bebe Rexha eventually gets it, but Rita Ora, you know, she doesn't go down without a fight.
Of course, you coming on from the edit department who loves Rita Ora. We have to find a way to mention Rita Ora.
Always enjoy giving Rita some shine. Leanne Rimes, maybe Kelsea Ballerini now?
Yeah.
I think that makes sense.
Sadly, there's so few women to choose from in the
really.
Country.
So if we already have Carrie Underwood and Taylor Swift says no, she's not really in country anymore anyway.
Right.
You know,
I like that, yeah.
Yeah, Kelsey Ballerina. I think Kelsey Ballerina gets there on her own merits anyway. I don't think that's just a placeholder. Melissa Etheridge, I think maybe now Brittany Howard of the Alabama Shakes.
Yeah, I mean, they've never had that kind of crossover success.
True, but I like for an album.
Yeah, I like the cred that would bring
to it. Yeah, you need someone a little bit folkier, a little bit more of that NPR crowd, and somebody with pipes, and she obviously is, you know, she can hold her own with anybody there.
Right.
Mary J., I think, is still Mary J. There's only one of her. You don't replace her.
Yeah.
Sierra, I think that's where they have a rapper. I think you need to have a rapper this time.
Yeah.
So is it Cardi B or is it Nicki Minaj? I almost don't want to choose one.
I had them on my notes. I'm not picking sides.
Let's just say that it's probably one of those two. You know, I'm sure that hopefully be other candidates by the time they actually record this. But those are probably the two front runners. Mariah, I think, still Mariah.
No argument here.
No argument. Yeah. And Shanti, last one. I have LMA.
Yep. Wow. We had I swear we didn't look at notes, but I had all these same people
really?
Listed.
Well, is there anybody else that I didn't get to?
Christina Aguilera was originally a part of the plan for the original. She'd be a veteran at this point.
Maybe if they can't get Mary J. Blige, they get Christina instead to kind of be that sort of powerhouse late game vocalist.
Yeah.
I think the first call is still to Mary J. Blige in that case. And in terms of the producer, you know, you mentioned L.A. Reid and Babyface. I think this time it's a collab between Pharrell and Greg Kurstin. That's what I'm calling for that.
Yeah, I like that.
Yeah, you get
a little mix of pop, a little R&B,
but they're both still very contemporary. And I think they get along with everybody. I think that's the lineup.
Yes, kind of intrigue. It's only 10 years in some ways, and you look back and you think, okay, Beyonce is still huge. Carrie Underwood could be number one on the Billboard 200 next week. But 2008, Taylor Swift was about a little more than a year into her career. Katy Perry and Gaga were just starting then. Adele was just starting. So in some ways, this really was quite a while ago.
Yeah, and it's a nice little timestamp to remember a time when, you know, Natasha Bedingfield would be one of the first people they would put the call out to. Ashanti was still, a star on some level. And you watch that video, the person that tries to make the most of their time is Fergie. Like she really hogs that spotlight. And she was legitimately one of the biggest stars in the world at that time. Yeah. So it probably didn't even feel that that conspicuous at the moment.
But it's like We Are the World. Everyone was told, check your egos at the doors. So
well, most of them did.
Most of them.
not the Knowles family and not Fergie.
All right. So 10 years ago, a little flashback to Just Stand Up. So that's it. That's this week's Billboard Chart Beat podcast. Thank you so much, Andrew, for filling in.
Anytime with Trevor out, Trevor not out, happy to come on board.
All right. So we'll see if Trevor, I think he's back next week. So we'll see who's number one on the Hot 100 next week. Is it more Drake? Is it finally the week where Maroon 5 takes over? Does Eminem disrupt everything and come in next week? So we'll find out. Yep, we'll find out next week. We don't always mention this, but I wanted to mention it again. We just had a new good call we want to run. The Billboard Chart Beat Podcast hotline, 212-493-4021, 4021. 212-493-4021 for any chart questions or comments. We'll play them back coming up. And you can call too, Andrew, if you have a chart question.
Don't like talking on the phone very much. You know, I do it for my job when I have to, but I'm not making a lot of social calls these days.
All right. We'll talk to you next week on the Billboard Chart Beat Podcast. You follow your heart.